Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and sorry this week's show is a day late. I was flying yesterday, and I'm currently in Auckland with Adam Boileau in the flesh at Insomnia Security's Auckland office. They've very kindly given me a meeting room to work from for the day, so big thanks to the entire Insomnia crew for that. Big thanks also to Fossum and his mate Conan, who loaned me an extra microphone for the day. Cheers, guys. And yeah, we've got a great bunch of news to get through in this week's news segment in just a moment with Adam. Then it is on to this week's sponsor interview. And this week's sponsor is Remediant. Regular listeners would know Remediant. They do just-in-time privileged account management. You log into their console and enable privileged accounts, usually with a set time limit. What's interesting, though, is they started out with a heavy focus on Windows networks, and while that's still a big part of their business, they're really kicking some goals now in the DevOps world with what they're calling virtual directory binding. As you'll hear, it took me a minute to get my head around what they're doing, but it's actually pretty cool. They're sort of sitting in between Active Directory and all of your merry, you know, singing and dancing, horizontally scaling cloud Linux machines, and making that whole thing much less traumatic. So yeah, if you're having a hard time managing privileged accounts in your DevOps or cloud, you know, Linux environment, or you're about to kill yourself because you've been trying to fully integrate your Linux stuff with Active Directory, stick around for that interview because it is for you. That's coming up later, but right now it is, of course, time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, you know, we had Mr. Rob Joyce of the NSA on the show a few weeks ago talking about this whole concept of defending forward and, a little bit more public evidence or a little bit more public reporting on what that looks like hitting the internet over the last day or so.
Yeah, apparently the US Cyber Command decided to take out the internet service to the Russian Internet Research Agency Troll Farm during the midterm elections, on election day in November last year. And they just turned off their tubes, apparently, ruined their day. And maybe that's what defending forward looks like. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a couple of people with their hot takes on this, you know, on Twitter saying, that's pretty weak signaling. But that kind of makes the assumption that that's the only thing they did.
it kind of does. I mean, obviously, you know, turning off the tubes is a pretty clear signal that you're all up in the business, and, you know, the suggestion is going to be you're all up in all of the other things that are going on as well. You're, you know, in the cameras or in whatever else is going on in the building. And at the very least, it really is going to ruin the troll's day. You know, if they had a whole bunch of stuff planned for election day, then, well, you know, you're going to have to go hope that their DR facility is well equipped.
Yeah, so, you know, fun story anyway, right? Now, look, last week, we spoke at some length about this attack against the Australian Parliament House and Australia's political parties. The Wall Street Journal has weighed in with a story that attempts to attribute this attack to Iran. And look, immediately this story has been battered away by some fairly prominent Australian journalists who have what I assume, I think we can confidently say their sourcing is solid, and their sources say no, it was China. Funnily enough, this Wall Street Journal reporter did get in touch with me. I think a colleague of theirs says, Pat's an Australian and he covers this stuff, see what he thinks. And look, he sent me what he had. I sent him a reply saying, I don't think this means necessarily what you're driving at. Adam, you saw what he sent to me. You saw my response to him. What do you make of their assertion that, you know, this was in fact Iranian activity?
Well, I mean, so they sent through a bunch of data, which includes some sample data from Australian Parliament House kind of directory systems. Clearly somebody is up in their business. I don't have enough information to speculate about whether the MO of the people who are up in their business there is Iran or not. But, you know, clearly someone is up in their business. But there's nothing that, to my mind, says that this is the only crew that's up in their business.
Well, this is kind of what I said to the guy, right? Like, okay, so you're monitoring an Iranian APT crew and you've seen them, you know, maybe get some information out of an O365 tenancy. Okay, that's interesting, but that might not necessarily be what everybody's talking about right here. Like, I think the fatal mistake here is that they've linked, you know, I mean, this is a single sourced story essentially, and they've basically linked what this company has observed to what everyone else seems to think is a much bigger campaign by the Chinese state.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that there would only ever be one hacker crew up in your country's parliament, I mean, that seems a little incredulous, right? I mean, why wouldn't all of the hackers for all the different countries that are interested in Australian political machinations, such as they are, be up in your business? I mean, everyone's going to be in there, right? The fact there's only two seems incredible.
Yes, yes, I would agree with that. And I think we were speaking before we hit record, and was it China? Was it Iran?
Why not both?
Hooray! So, yeah, I think that's probably more likely what happened here in the... You know, certainly the depth of the Chinese operation seems to be what's got everyone a little bit freaked out in down under. Moving on, Brian Krebs is, from what I can tell, he's the first one with this story. We heard about these treason charges against Sergei Mikhailov and Ruslan Stoyanov in Russia. Ruslan Stoyanov, of course, was the senior employee at Kaspersky. Sergei Mikhailov was working for the FSB, you know, cybercrime unit. These guys have now been, you know, sent to prison for... I think Sergei got 22 years and Ruslan 14 years, which is, sucks to be them.
Yeah, that's a long time to be facing the can in Russia. And I mean, these are the two guys that were accused of, or a number of guys that were accused of handing over information to the Americans to help with some American investigations into Russian hacker activity. And it was kind of tied up with this guy, Pavel Vublevsky, who was one of the, like, ChronoPay, you know.
Well, he is ChronoPay.
Well, he is, was the ChronoPay guy, subject of Brian Krebs' book, actually, The Spam Kings. And yeah, general, you know, all around internet mafioso guy. And yeah, kind of, you know, this whole story, which we've been tracking on and off for a couple of years now, is really just, you know, there's so much Russian politics going on in this story. And it's just kind of sad that, you know, for whatever reason, people are going to end up in prison for 20 years.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Kim Zenz, who is a friend of the show, you know, I think the allegation was that she was somehow Ruslan Stoyanov's handler. CIA handler, which is pretty funny because, for you know, if she is a CIA officer, she's not very stealthy. Let's just put it that way. And you know, I think there's quite a few people out there who seem to believe that these charges came about as a result of some, you know, domestic interagency bullshit in Russia. Basically, you know, you've got that not everybody gets along. Different arms of the Russian government don't necessarily get along. And then you've got people like Pavel Vrublevsky, you know, ChronoPay, you know, who's in the mix in all sorts of unusual ways, went to prison, got sprung for prison to apparently help the government build something, and all sorts of allies. And he really had some ill will towards both of these guys, and now they're in prison. So, look, I mean, it's impossible to say whether justice has been served here because the trial is largely, you know, done in secret. I mean, we don't even know precisely what the allegations are. But, look, just my reading of it is it stinks to high heaven, you know. And some people are saying that the charges levelled against Stoyanov in particular were just designed to... you know, introduce a chilling effect and stop Russian researchers from sharing any type of threat intelligence with the outside.
Yeah, I mean, it would certainly make it very hard, you know, being a researcher at Kaspersky, being a researcher at any one of the other, you know, great Russian technology companies to do your work, really, because it is such an international game.
Yeah, yeah. Now, look, at some point we're going to get Kim on the show to give her side of this whole thing. So that should be interesting. And yeah, we'll bring that to you at some point. The least surprising headline of the week comes to us via CyberScoop. Apparently, DPRK hackers have been, you know, phishing various people before the Trump-Kim summit. I don't think that's very surprising. Do you?
Yeah, it makes sense that, you know, they're interested in all the people that are involved in the summit. And, of course, you know, emails, phishing lures around the topic are going to be attractive to people who are involved. And, yeah, we've seen similar sort of things happen with the previous summit, so... kind of makes sense.
Well, Trump and Kim are such good friends. I figure, you know, he doesn't need to ask his intelligence service anything. He can just ask Trump direct because they're homies, right?
Oh, God.
Yeah. Now, we've got some interesting research here about bare metal cloud. Now, look, I'm going to say this. This kind of, in this very specific instance, it relates to Supermicro hardware. What I find interesting about the Bloomberg, I'm going to call this the Bloomberg effect, right, is Bloomberg writes this story that turns out to be completely, like, made up. But it seems to have... inspired some really interesting research into, like, motherboard security. And we've got an example, like Exhibit A right here, which is these researchers figuring out how to, you know, backdoor hardware by messing with the, you know, BMC.
Yeah, this is a set of research for people who provide cloud services using bare metal machines. So what we would have called, you know, traditional, you know, leased hosting, where you lease a box, you get the bare metal access. In this case, the researchers were looking at ways to persist across relinquishing the hardware back to the cloud provider, in this case through the bare metal controller, the lights out management systems on the Supermicro hardware that I think IBM's SoftLayer hosting platform was using. And yeah, they would modify the firmware of the BMC, hand it back, and then kind of cycle through buying new boxes until they got the one that they'd modified back, and they could verify that the firmware changes that they had made persisted. They actually added users to the bare metal controllers, like embedded Linux as well, and those went away, but the firmware modifications that they made stayed in place. And so, yeah, I think the research here is suggesting that perhaps if you're buying that kind of service, that, you know, you want to think about the fact that hardware isn't fresh. And if you're running that kind of service, then probably you need to reflash, you know, the BMC and all of the other firmware on every connected PCIe device on those things. Or maybe just torch the whole damn lot, like throw it in the shredder at the end of the lease.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And there are, you know, people are, I'm sure there's a bunch of listeners saying, like, why would you ever lease bare metal these days? But there's a bunch of applications that require it just for, you know, when latency is really crucial, right? You need that bare metal access.
Yeah, I mean, some people are uncomfortable with, you know, being exposed to the management systems that come with, you know, even dedicated but virtualized platforms.
Come on, as if the management stuff around this isn't a horror show
well,
as well.
Well, right? Of course, right? And that's the joke, right? I mean, it's the people who are doing this because security, you know, they're just moving the risk around. Obviously, it's not just Supermicro. Supermicro in this story, you know, A, because, you know, perhaps some people are, you know, Supermicro has brand recognition now, but B, Supermicro is just a really big vendor in this kind of space. They're a great, you know, kind of hardware OEM one tier down from the, you know, the HPs and the Dells.
Yeah, yeah. Now, look, this next piece, not strictly security, I guess, although, you know, Alex Damos's keynote from Black Hat year before last, he said, you know, abuse, platform abuse and stuff, you know, really should be considered, that should move under security. And I tend to agree with him. But this story is really about the human cost of trying to tackle some of this platform abuse. The reason I'm talking about this story this week is because it just really seems to have struck a chord with a whole bunch of people this week.
Yeah, this piece, The Verge went and talked to a bunch of people who work as content moderators for contractors to Facebook, where, you know, are responsible with looking at all of the content that gets flagged as being, you know, abusive or, you know, for whatever review by Facebook users. And they're the ones that have to sit there and decide whether, you know, videos of someone getting murdered are acceptable on Facebook or not, which, you know, what a world we live in. And it's just such a depressing read. I mean, these people are making, you know, a couple of bucks an hour above minimum wage and, you know, getting PTSD, getting traumatized, spending all day working in a, you know, by the second clocked, you know, low wage job, you know, looking at human sewerage all day long. It's just such a miserable read.
Yeah, I mean, I just think of the police that I've met who worked on child exploitation stuff, right? And, you know, they were messed up. I know people personally who've been messed up by that stuff. And then you think, okay, well, hang on. If you're working content moderation for a major platform, you're not just getting trickles of that stuff. It's a fire hose in your face all day long. It's going to mess you up.
Yeah, and I mean, there's some stories here in interviews with people where they've said, you know, this stuff, not only does it traumatize you, sometimes it actually makes you believe it. I mean,
these people are moderating conspiracy theories. Yeah, and people who are becoming flat earthers and stuff and anti-vaxxers and believing in QAnon and stuff because that's just what they're exposed to all day at work.
Yeah, so miserable. And I guess it really, you know, it underscores, like, to me, this reminded me of the, you know, the argument of, well, we don't take into account the full life cycle cost of fossil fuels, for example, in terms of the carbon in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And this is the same thing, right? We don't, if you're a Facebook or a YouTube, you know, you're not taking into account the full human cost of running the platform, right? You've got externalities that you're not dealing with by paying $14 an hour to some, you know, 20-year-old.
Yeah, and I just don't know that this is the way to fix this stuff. Hiring a lot of people at crappy wages to be traumatized, you know, like, I just wonder when we're going to hit a real tipping point with this stuff. But let's see. Let's see. Now, look, back on topic, I guess. We've got some great research here from Duo Security. Now, one thing I've noticed about Duo is it's almost like they've got a habit of doing, look, I know they probably won't like this characterization, but I'm going to call it activist research, right? So Twitter has a bot problem. So they do research on how easy it is to identify Twitter bots. Chrome has a dodgy extensions problem. So now they've created a tool which sort of, it's a dodginess meter for Chrome extensions. So I kind of like this idea that Duo are looking at some of these bigger problems in tech and, you know, kind of pointing out that the solutions aren't necessarily that impossible, right?
Yeah, I mean, Dewar has a clear interest in the browser being a robust platform, and browser extensions are one of the main things that are wrong with the Chrome ecosystem. So, you know, it is a kind of a natural fit for them to go deep. But yeah, they do seem to come up with, you know, interesting bits of research here. And this is one of them. They're, it's called the CR Excavator, Chrome Extension Excavator. And essentially they wrote a thing that rummages through Chrome extensions and kind of rates the various risks associated with them, what permissions they need, whether they load JavaScript content from external domains, all that kind of thing, and lets you just kind of plug in the name of an extension that you might be considering using and get some metrics about how rubbish it is. And that's, you know, that is actually genuinely useful if you must run Chrome extensions.
Well, and the thing is, of course, Twitter know how to find bots, right? They're probably not too interested in getting rid of them because user growth is everything. You know, and Chrome, I mean, Google is stacked to the ceiling with very smart people who could do this if they wanted. So what I like about stuff like this is it's really pointing it out publicly, like, hey, you know, at least doing this is not too hard.
Yeah, exactly. And it would, you know, it is going to help, right? I mean, people have no real good metrics to judge how risky an extension is. And certainly from a corporate level, if you're dealing with a corporate deployment of Chrome, having some whitelist, you know, this is a useful data source to have. So yeah, good on Duo.
Now, this one's interesting. About a week ago, the byline in this one, the dateline in this one says Wednesday, the 20th of February. Toyota Australia was apparently having a bad time, right? Like the story was, headline here from The Guardian, Toyota Australia says no customer data taken in attempted cyber attack, right?
Spin!
So you just sort of read about it and it's like, okay, they're struggling to get some systems back online. So, you know, you and me, we probably read a story like that, we think ransomware, whatever, right?
Yeah.
Okay, then I get some interesting DMs from a source that I won't name, a source that I don't even know. You know, basically someone DMs me and says, hey, you know, Toyota really got hosed. Okay, Toyota really got hosed. And I'm thinking, okay, it's a person I don't know on, you know, on Twitter, whatever. But I'll keep my eye out and, you know, maybe do the odd Google News search for Toyota Australia. Lo and behold, 25th of February 2019, a report from Just Auto says, I'll just read a bit of it. Toyota Australia has provided a further update after news emerged last week that it was the victim of a cyber attack. In a statement, they said their IT systems are still offline as remedial work continues following an attempted cyber attack. Now, guys, if everything's been down for 5 days, this is not an attempted cyber attack. You know, once someone doesn't have a pulse, it's not attempted murder, it's murder. And apparently they're having like supply chain problems. They've got 279 dealers in Australia. They're apparently, quote, still operational and able to help customers with their inquiries. However, there have been some impacts to parts supply, which is subsequently delaying servicing at some dealerships. This sounds like a disaster.
It does. They're saying that one of the services that are still offline includes email, which, you know, you would imagine is kind of important in the operation of their business, and there's a bunch of other systems that are not also not available internally. Does rather sound like they got their domain wrecked, or at least some of the core corporate systems interfered with. Now, we don't really know. I mean, they say, well, no customer data was taken. Well, maybe it's because it's all turned off at the moment. but yeah, we don't know whether they turned it off because they realized the hackers have stolen their Curb TGT, or, you know, whether there's something else going on. But either way, it sounds like they're having a real bad day, bad week.
Yeah, well, I think it, you know, maybe mystery tweeter is, you know, a little bit credible now. And their word was, before this other story broke, was that all corporate systems were down, including landlines, email, Slack, Jira, and they were dealing with mobile. Like, mobile was their only connectivity. So,
sounds like a bad day.
Yeah, I don't know. Toyota's been having some problems with dodgy diesel particulate filters, so I'm going to go with disgruntled customer because, you know, those DPFs, really bad. Really, really bad. Bugs in Drupal, bad ones, funny ones.
Yeah, there's a bug in Drupal, it's remote code exec through deserialization, PHP deserialization bugs.
I know how much you love them.
Oh, I do love to deserialize some things. And this one, yeah, it's in Drupal core, of course, which is bad. Drupal 8 core, not 7, which I guess at least is some, you know, gives some respite to people who haven't yet upgraded. But yeah, then there was a whole
When your best defense is not patching.
Yeah, exactly. there was some confusion because the initial reports from Drupal said you had to have like post or patch method, HTTP methods enabled. I've seen some examples of this being done via GET, the sneaky get method, and hackers would never use that.
Yes.
But either way, if you've got Drupal,
you could even use the hacker tool wget.
Probably even Internet Explorer would suffice here. But yeah, obviously, if you are a Drupal admin, you're probably used to having to patch a lot of things in a hurry. So in that case, you totally got this covered. You're fine.
It's out there too. It's in the wild, man.
Yeah, there's bugs in the wild. Right, there's certainly, if you click through some of the links from the news list, you'll find some work exploits and stuff. So you know, use those to responsibly test your systems.
Lorenzo at Motherboard has written this one up, and I'm not quite sure I'm jumping on the outrage train with everyone else on this. The story says that, you know, some guys who used to work at a hacking team have, you know, left that business. They've created some blockchain surveillance tech that they have now sold to Coinbase. And that's bad, apparently, because these guys used to work at Hacking Team. And I'm thinking, hey, isn't it great that they're not doing that anymore? I think it would be nice if everyone working for dodgy companies like that would not do that anymore. So why don't we, you know, give them $5 and a sun hat and say, hey, we think it's great that you don't work for people who sell malware to Sudan anymore.
Yeah, it is kind of hard to get too worked up about this this particular story. Although, you know, obviously working on the blockchain is also you know, plausibly not ethical, given the, you know, energy usage of the Bitcoin blockchain.
Man, that's like you just took my woke and raised me. that's great. You went with the ultimate climate woke there.
Dear. But yeah, this is Alora Naga, actually, who some of you may recognize from the classic hacker tool Etacap, which, you know, was a lot of fun for layer 2 network stunts back in the old days. So yeah, clearly those guys still know how to use computers, and you know, it's good that they're not causing journalists to get murdered in the Sudan.
Yes, I agree. So that's great that they have moved out of that, but apparently some people very upset. Now, Dark Matter, of course, you know, we spoke about Project Raven, which was apparently you know, being conducted in the UAE, a surveillance program being conducted in the UAE with assistance from a company called Dark Matter. Now, of course, look, we spoke about that report. One thing we should point out, though, is that Dark Matter is actually quite a large company. Chris Bing's reporting was, you know, from the best I could tell, was bang on, talking about the offensive sort of SIGINT capability of the UAE using contractors who are being run through Dark Matter. Okay, cool. We can accept all that. But we can also say, you go to LinkedIn and type in Dark Matter, there's like 550 staff just on LinkedIn, and I'm guessing not all of them are doing offensive stuff, right? They do a lot of defensive stuff.
Yeah, there's a bunch of people we know, expat Aussies, all sorts, all up in the dark matters.
They are indeed. That said, I don't think it's necessarily a great idea that they get a root cert in Firefox, which is something that they've asked for, okay? So, yeah.
Yeah, so apparently they do issue a bunch of certs, and they have an existing trust root through the Quo Vadis registry. They have an intermediate CA that they can sign stuff already to a certain extent. So if you go look in your trust store, you might already see Dark Matter certs. But yeah, them asking to be put into the Mozilla CA trust store, it's a little bit, yeah, I can see a few people are sucking their teeth at that one. And of course, the Mozilla CA store is then used by a bunch of other things as well. The Linux distributions use that as the base as well. And that's kind of one of the concerns, is like, okay, Firefox is one thing, but, you know, packages being delivered across apt or whatever, to the extent that apps SSL anyway, which isn't. But, you know, I mean, having a trust store in all of your Linux boxes being stood up in the cloud, also kind of a problem. So, yeah.
Well, and Dark Matter's issued this, you know, response, right, saying, I assure you, we are only doing defensive stuff. And I don't know, it seems a strange time to now come out and deny that story, right? That seems like, okay, you waited a little while there, and I don't know, it's just a bit of a weaselly thing. And they say, oh, you know, we publish everything to a certificate transparency log. Before we started recording, you and I had this conversation. We couldn't work it out. Someone who's listening will know. But I wonder if, like, once you have that level of trust in a browser, if you're in the root store, right, can you actually, like, mint some certificates and not publish those ones to the transparency log? And then, you know, can you sort of turn off the logging, issue a few certs, and then turn it back on? You and me, we're not sure about that.
Yeah, I don't know enough about their actual plumbing, you know, whether the certificate logs have some kind of, you know, blockchain-style validation process, or at least a counter or something.
So hang on. You would like to see more blockchain? Is that what you say? You heard it here first on Risky Business. From here on after, you will be known. From now on, you will be known as Adam Boileau, blockchain evangelist.
Kill me now.
Blockchain evangelist Adam Barlow. Dear,
dear. Anyway, please. someone who understands transparency logging, maybe I'll ask Pipes, he knows about that kind of thing, can explain to us whether or not you can just turn off the logs and have yourself, the bank heist, replay the security cams certificate issuing thing.
CyberScoop has this one, which is a write-up of some IBM research, which, okay, the headline is, "For many crooks, malware is out and PowerShell attacks are in," IBM says. Now, this one's funny, Adam, because you reckon they've got this, like, literally backwards.
Yeah, oh dear. So, I mean, this article is dated February 26, 2019, so this is a modern piece, and yet, these days you talk to modern red teamers, they're like, oh, don't use PowerShell. There's so much logging. Everyone's had to give up on PowerShell because it's, it was the place that everyone ditched malware to use 6 years ago. And it certainly feels like IBM might be a little bit behind the game here.
Either that or the crooks that they're, their caseload, those crooks are a little bit behind.
Maybe, IBM right? X-Force is investigating, old slow criminals, maybe? I don't know.
Burn. But yeah, so I guess what you're saying is don't believe the hype on this one. PowerShell's no longer the bonanza it once was.
Yeah, I mean, IBM stats that 57% of attacks, oh my God, use peers exec. Not exactly on the bleeding edge of hack technique right there.
I remember when PowerShell, though, like really took off as a useful thing. And it wasn't that long ago, right? Like I saw a Windows guy. He wasn't really that much of a security guy back then, but it was at CrikeyCon, and just his demo was, that was the good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, having a proper shell, like a proper scripting language, proper runtime environment for dynamic, running scripts and stuff, super useful. Like, welcome to what the Unix has had,
There were so many dumb things with it as well. Like, you could set it up to only run signed scripts, but then you could just turn it off, right?
I mean, PowerShell 1 and 2, the old ones that predate the logging, predate the AMSI and stuff for logging, like, still pretty useful. But yeah, these days, if you try and roll only PowerShell on a modern Win 10, in Server 2012 environment with a competent blue team, you're going to get wrecked.
Yeah. With a competent blue team, which is, that's a hell of a caveat.
Maybe not IBM's customers.
I'm going to get mail. We've got a report from TechCrunch here. I've seen it doing the rounds. There's apparently some bugs in 4G, 5G protocols that will, quote, allow attackers to intercept calls and track phone locations. I've given this a read, and it looks like, a legitimate couple of issues here.
Yeah, it's some legitimate research. It's not world-ending stuff, and in the scale of things that go wrong with cell networks, it's not that bad. I mean, there's a couple of attacks that they're talking about here, which is, for example, decloaking the IMSI, the phone number or the identifier of a particular phone, which is normally either assigned a temporary one or obscured on the mobile network, and we'll be able to figure out where a particular handset is by the sort of pinging it from the cell tower, in this case by kind of half placing a call so the phone never rings, but the cell tower will actually go out and do the poll process to initiate call delivery, and then you can kind of look around and figure out by observing the network where those things are. So yeah, they're sort of incremental attacks in a way, rather than this piece hyperbolically says the latest blow to cellular network security. It's not really a blow.
Hey, come on, man. Journo's got to have a bit of fun, right? We like to feel important. But, is this something that can be trivially fixed? Because that's a problem that I tend to see with a lot of this type of research is, people do the research and then it's like, oh, well, we finalized the spec, so unfortunately, there's nothing we can do.
Exactly. That is a very real problem with telco stuff because it is, it takes such a long time to roll out the standards. There's so many vendors, so many bits of equipment, there's so much plant in the network that isn't going to get upgraded. Yeah, I mean, a lot of these things are, like SS7, just going to live forever.
Yeah.
And we'll be stuck with the consequences of it. But, I mean, if we're going to roll out 5G, it might be nice to, try and fix up a few things before we, completely ruin it for the next 15 years.
Now, look, we're not going to cover all of the bad, horrible things that happened to people who own cryptocurrency this week because, we just don't have time, right? But there is one story that we just have to talk about because it is just too funny not to. This one comes, of course, from Catalin Campanu, who seems to, really enjoy writing these types of stories because there's usually a couple a week. Like, I swear, 20-30% of everything we talk about every week is written by Catalin. So well done. Well done, guy. But tell us about this one, Adam, because it is quite delicious.
So there's this cryptocurrency wallet app called CoinOmi, and it's a desktop just a application that's built on top of Chromium. So it's kind of one of these sort of web browser, but client-side applications. And yeah, you can enter, you know, build your own crypto wallet, add your currencies to it, use that to spend all of your dollars on important things in the cryptocurrency markets. It's built on WebTech. And apparently when you go to generate the passphrase for your wallet that your key is derived from, that secures all of your funds in the world because you're a Bitcoin enthusiast, this thing was sending the passphrase off to Google's spell checking API.
In clear text, don't forget. In clear text, in clear. HTTP. Hey, oh, hang on, mess. Hang on. I'm going to have to do it.
Do the...
Had to do it. With apologies to Paul Lanzi, who absolutely hates the sad trombone. Sorry, guy. But yeah, wow, what can you say? Look, another thing, it's not even in the news list, but what is it, CoinHive? This was the service that allowed you to embed JavaScript in your website so that people who visited your website would generate... you know, would mine currency for you. And then, of course...
Because that's a legitimate business idea.
Well, and then, of course, you know, it's an alternative to advertising, they said. And then, of course, what happened is everyone, like, created CoinHive accounts, owned a bunch of websites and injected their code into them. You know, like, they actually just announced today that they're shutting down. I know, I am shocked. Adam, you look shocked.
I'm so shocked.
His jaw is on the floor, but there you go. Now, look, in this next story proves that POS doesn't just stand for point of sale.
No, it does not. North Country Business Products, a Minnesota-based point-of-sale vendor, announced that a whole bunch of their point-of-sale terminals had got well and owned. Something like 140 locations, shops and restaurants and things around Minnesota. Yeah, malware all up in their POS terminals, presumably nicking credit card data. We haven't actually seen any data that says specifically the card data was taken, but that is why you own point-of-sale systems.
You would kind of like assume one thing leads to the other, right?
Yes, exactly. You
were. Yes, indeed. Now, this next one's pretty interesting. Some academics from Greece have looked at doing some funky stuff with service workers, browser service workers, so that you can do bad things that persist. And they seem to be saying that these bad things can persist, well, you know, in perpetuity. You're not so sure.
So yeah, the service workers provide a mechanism for a browser to, you know, for a website to have a browser store and run bits of code, or bits of JavaScript on their behalf. And there is a mechanism for those to kind of persist even after the tab, you know, browser tab has been closed. And people have long been running, you know, running things you didn't particularly want in a browser tab, you know, beef hooks, that kind of thing, that do the attacker's bidding whilst you're visiting a site. But once the tab's gone, the code dies. And service workers provide a mechanism for long-running code to live in a browser. I'm not a super web hacker guy, being kind of old and into Unix and networks. But I was under the impression that there were some limits on how long service workers could run for. This research seemed to suggest that they have come up with a mechanism like abusing the various browser features that allow you to, you know, wake up service workers. There's some kind of synchronization process where you can request them to run things and then, you know, kind of use that to build indefinitely running service workers. Now, there was a really good talk about service workers at KiwiCon last year, but unfortunately I was out the back doing kind of con org stuff and didn't see the talk.
Printing badges.
And we haven't actually got around to watching the videos yet. We were supposed to, all the organizers were going to sit down and watch the talks, because everyone said that one was really good, and I didn't actually see it yet. So I'm a little vague, but I mean, on the face of it, this seems like really useful stuff. And you know, if CoinHive was still alive, this would seem to be quite a useful place to stick your coin mining.
So look, okay, say this is true and you've got, you know, the ability to run a service worker in perpetuity, what would you use that for?
Being able to interact with other services, you know, kind of using it as a proxy where the same origin policy or where core was going to let you do that. That could be handy. You know, other visibility to internal networks. I mean, there's all sorts of things I guess you could do with it. There's lots of...
See, I thought what I would have thought would be one use is it would enable you to save the target for later, right? So if you've got the ability to get your code to reach out for content, you know, you might wait till the browser they're using, you know, has a patch available for it, RE the patch, develop an exploit, and then deliver it through that access that you've got. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so sort of like watering hole where you have them visit at some point in time and then defer actually shelling them until later when you've got a bug in the future. Yeah,
That's kind of what I was thinking. Yeah,
that's pretty smart. You'd make a good hacker.
I really wouldn't. But anyway. Oh, yeah, there's some bug being fixed in WinRAR that's been around for 19 years. This one rings a bell. Oh, speaking of ones that ring a bell, a couple of weeks ago we spoke about this story where someone had put an exploit in DNA that, you know, exploited some file format bug in the sequencing software. Turns out that story was from like 2017 and I just didn't check the date, but it had been going wild on Twitter, which is why how it wound up in the news list. So sorry about that, because I'm sure we would have covered it at the time in 2017. But yeah, it tells you a little bit about what happens to someone's brain when they're processing this much news. But yeah, this one also rings a bell. WinRAR, yeah, security issue, 19 years old. That's pretty bad.
Yeah, this was a bug in the parser for the ACE archive format, which WinRAR, of course, handles lots of formats other than RAR, and they were bundling a vulnerable version of UNACE 2.dll. Turns out they actually lost access to the source code for that in, like, 2005. So the patch here is to just rip out the functionality for ACE format archives in WinRAR, and, yeah, probably nothing of value is lost except for shells.
Oh, I don't want to spend too much time on this one, but Dow Jones had a bad day. They've got this weird watch list of like rich people and dangerous people, 2.4 million supposedly high-risk clients. They keep this in a database. It's like a financial intelligence service. It seems like valuable data, which is why I'm kind of surprised they just left it in Elasticsearch available to everyone on the internet.
Yeah, not ideal, I guess. On an Amazon instance, internet-facing, no auth, and yeah, some people helped themselves to it. Womp womp.
Womp womp indeed. And Intel is open sourcing a firmware security tool, which I read this, I think that's great news, but I don't know if the tool's any good.
Yeah, this is they're called HBFA, the host-based firmware analyzer. It's essentially a set of security tools for analyzing UEFI firmware built on Intel's Theano core, like open source, libraries and stuff for building firmware. So, you know, it's of relevant interest to people who make Theano core based firmware for x86 PCs, which is, you know, the four or five BIOS vendors in the world. So not a huge audience, but, you know, I'm sure some people will find other uses for it as well.
Now, this one is right up your alley. Thunderclap. Tell us about Thunderclap.
So, yes, there's been another round of research and another round of reporting into DMA vulnerabilities via Thunderbolt, which was goes back to, via DMA attacks via Firewire. It's one of the things I did many years ago.
Winlock Pwn, for those of you who don't remember, that was Adam's tool, which was, yeah, he spoke about that at RoxCon in when?
Like 2006, maybe?
2006 or something, and then I convinced him to release it, and I wrote the story for the newspapers, and the editor gave it the headline, "Unlock any Windows system with no password." so it wound up going quite berserk, and I believe for the next few days you were getting people recognize you in the street.
It was a little bit weird. A little bit.
It was not, quite funny.
Not yes. The normal hacker thing. Anyway, so, and of course, you writing up that story is what led to us sitting here in this room.
This is true. Many years later.
Anyway. So DMA attacks. Thunderbolt is a transport mechanism for, you know, essentially, amongst other things, PCIe bus. PCIe talks DMA, which lets hardware devices reach directly into system memory and do things so that peripheral devices like, say, network cards can dump data into the right place in memory without the intervention of the CPU, which gives them great performance. The Thunderbolt port is also transferred over USB-C in some cases, essentially lets you plug in and get direct memory access to people's hardware. The current round of reporting has been about... there's an attack with a name, which we don't use, which is really just plug in via Thunderbolt and read memory. The controls that were put in place over the years to deal with this kind of DMA attacks, it involves using the what's called the IOMMU, which is the thing that does access control on memory for peripheral devices. Apple is actually the only major vendor that has turned on IOMMU support in their mainstream operating systems to restrict Thunderbolt and Firewire and other DMA devices from being able to just access all of main memory, which is certainly how it used to be. Microsoft added support into the version of Windows 10 that shipped like 3 months ago, and this research has been around bypassing some of the controls that those IOMMUs put in place for those platforms that have it, which is to say, you know, macOS and maybe Linux, where your Thunderbolt doesn't work very well. Anyway, net result is if you can plug in a device to your laptop, chances are you can read and write at least some of main memory. The research that's been addressing Apple has been looking at how the IOMMU restricts access to memory, and some of the areas that are permitted include things like, you know, keyboard buffers and other thing, network buffers that are other peripheral devices, and the granularity of controls that the IOMMU can put in place, you know, maybe is not ideal. And that's kind of where this research is heading. But for the vast majority of people, like, DMA attacks have been a thing for 15 years and are still a thing, and there's not really a whole bunch of change there.
No, I mean, this is one of those areas of research that is always going to be that type of arms race, really, isn't it?
Yes, and it's, you know, also one of these trade-offs of usability, right? Having to configure permissions for every device you plug in, especially what can be quite technical permissions, you know, is not a thing that end users want to have to deal with. And indeed, like the Windows prompt that it now says has when you plug in a Thunderbolt device and asks, you know, do you want to give this access once or many times, you know, are not particularly useful unless you're plugging into what you think is a power charging port. And then probably you shouldn't see a prompt and don't plug into the NSA
probably,
brand.
But
one.
How many people know that, et cetera, et cetera, right?
You
know,
exactly.
It's just, it is one of those things. DMA, what are you going to do?
Yeah, and I mean, even if it's not Thunderbolt, right, there's a dock port on the bottom of your laptop.
Oh, or look, when you released WinLockPwn, one of the things I remember about your work, the WinLockPwn, right, where you could just plug in to a FireWire port, is when you released that tool. And I, you know, before when I said that I convinced you to release it, I was just kidding. I wouldn't do something like that because I'm a very ethical journalist who does not get involved in the news. Anyway, people very quickly figured out that you could, use this attack against laptops that didn't have FireWire ports by plugging a FireWire card into a PCMCIA port, and Windows would just like auto install the drivers and give you DMA access. And it's just, you know.
Well, I mean, you know, PCMCIA was ISA, card bus is essentially PCI,
right?
Thunderbolt is PCIe, the dock port on the bottom of your laptop is just PCIe.
That's right, the bus is the bus is the bus.
It's a bus, and welcome aboard.
That's gold. That is absolutely gold. All right, now, second last story this week, and, you know, I love this one. Now, this is a way to do SIGINT collection. This is a very novel way to do information collection, Adam. Tell us what happened at the North Korean embassy Spain.
So the North Koreans, they do like to cyber, right? They like to go out and help themselves to some bitcoins, help themselves to people's information, you know, through the cyber techniques. And we've talked about, you know, defending forward with cyber. Sometimes you just want to go kinetic. And in this case, a bunch of unidentified men rolled up to North Korea's embassy in Madrid, Spain, bust in the door, bound and gagged everybody, and then loaded all of the computers into a truck and drove off.
Now, either this is just like a new type of APT behavior or some exchange...
Advanced punchy threat.
Yeah. Or some exchange, crypto exchange operator really wants their Bitcoin back. That's...
I mean, it might work. I guess the North Koreans do have all of your stolen Bitcoin. Maybe it's the Christchurch crew rolled over there to help themselves to some of their Bitcoins back. But yes, maybe that's what happened.
Now, look, before we go, I just wanted to mention an event that's taking place. It's look, it is sadly sold out already, but I did want to mention this event, 0xcc, which is a training conference in Melbourne, which is happening 26-27 of April. Now, this is a women-only event, very much in the sort of spirit, I guess, of Black Hoodie. And it's just been tremendously successful. It's the first time they're running this, and you know, it's the first women-only event, as far as I know, of this scale that's happening in Australia. And it's being organised by Alana Guo, and you know, she's put this whole thing together, and it's been tremendously successful. And you know, I asked her to tell me a little bit about why she's organising this event, and here's what she said.
My hope for 0xcc is that women can learn from and inspire each other, as well as being able to talk about issues at hand, so everyone can have a more well-rounded and thought-out understanding of problems and situations from hearing people's experiences and what they've done. If you're just starting out in the industry, while most people are lovely, you might run into some unsavory characters who do not represent the industry but can leave a very bad taste in your mouth. And I'm afraid that some people will see that and decide that they don't want to be in the industry. All of us who are attending want to learn and want to meet other women and are here because we love security. And I think the opportunity to meet other people and just be assumed that you're there because you love security and not because you're someone's girlfriend and not be hit on or harassed, hopefully, would be eye-opening for a lot of people, as it was for me.
Yeah, so that's Alana there telling us about, 0cc, which looks to be a fabulous event. And I guess, look, the reason I wanted to talk about this on the show is that I suspect that if you spring up an event like this pretty much in any city in the world, you might be surprised at how successful it is.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of demand for this kind of thing, right? I mean, I certainly know how many women come to KiwiCon, how many people, women are involved in running KiwiCon. You know, there are absolutely these groups there, and it's, you know, it's great that we're at a position in this industry where, you know, you can do this, right? You can stand up an event, and I gather they've sold out.
Yeah, no, they have, and they I think they issued more tickets and they went as well. So, you know, the demand is there, and I think that's, I think that's worth noting, you know. So if you are a woman who's listening to this show and, you know, you've been thinking about running an event like this, I think, you know, all signs point to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, all of the people who've been involved in, you know, things like Black Hoodie and things like this, you know, are all very willing to share their experiences and help out, right? Because everyone wants to make the industry a better place. And of course, you know, other people, other conference organizers are willing to share and help as well. So absolutely, if you think this is a thing you'd like to do, and I, you know, I can't advocate getting into conference running as a hobby because it's a terrible hobby, don't do it. But if you do decide that you're that kind of sucker, then there's definitely plenty of scope, plenty of demand, and plenty of people who will, you know, find events like this really rewarding and in some cases, you know, career and life changing.
Well, mate, that's actually it for this IRL edition of the news. Thanks so much, mate, for organising this space for me to work in, this baby-free space in Auckland for me to work in this week. And I guess after we sign off, I'm gonna get to editing, and I guess you're going to the bottle shop?
At the very least, I have to go to a meeting first.
Ah, well,
and then maybe after that I could do with a cold one. That would be nice.
Excellent. And yeah, I'll speak to you next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat, and I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news. Big thanks to him for that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Tim Keeler of Remediant. Remediant is an interesting company. They started off as a bootstrap startup with some interesting ideas around privileged account management. Basically, their appliance, which is virtual or physical, allows you to introduce sort of a choke point for privileged accounts. Administrators have to 2FA into their appliance to enable privileged access on the boxes they want to admin. Remediant is one of those things that gets you places pretty quickly in the Windows world. But funnily enough, the process of the Remediant team eating their own dog food has meant that they're kicking some goals in Linux land now as well. Now, look, there are some truly horrible pluggable auth modules designed to glue Linux to Active Directory that make administrators weep salty, salty tears. And Adam's still sitting with me and he's miming the gun through the mouth gesture, right? He's still here when I'm doing my script read. Sorry to break through the fourth wall, yes. right now. But yeah, some of them just straight up don't work properly. Now, Remediant's tech was, you know, really an appliance that was originally designed to do stuff for Windows boxes. As I mentioned, you know, if you wanted to do admin things to a box, you log into to their box. It enables the access for a time-locked period. You do your thing, then the account loses privileges. Now, look, as you're going to hear, they've made this thing work well with Linux boxes too, and it's still agentless. So if you enable a privileged account through Remediant's appliance, that appliance will basically log into the Linux box for you and add the account to the sudoers file. But you can still manage the provisioning through Active Directory. So essentially, they've engineered their box to be able to sit in between your Active Directory and your horizontally scaling Linux infrastructure. And, you know, this sounds like, to me at least, a pretty useful thing. So here's Remediant CEO Tim Keeler telling us all about it.
You know, what we've really done is just, you know, initially focused on just-in-time administration, which is all about, you know, giving dynamic administrative privileges for individuals in the company rather than having 24/7 persistent access. And since then, we've really expanded and evolved the technology and platform. And what we're starting to do is a lot of deployments in our Linux DevOps environments, because what we've realized is through a lot of conversations is this is the area where companies are moving towards, whether it's a native cloud or hybrid cloud scenarios. And really what they're trying to understand is how privileged access ties into all that, because you're dealing with highly ephemeral workloads. So rather than going the traditional route of, you know, having this Linux workload spin up and go through a full Active Directory join just so you can have the benefits of centralized authentication, what we do is manage all of that binding through our own platform. So when a workload gets spun up, we automatically get a feed that's triggered into our system. So we know, hey, this system is online, it needs to be managed. We'll connect
to
that system.
How do you get that feed? I'm curious.
Oh, so that's really simple. If you're using Azure or EC2 or Google, they'll feed event notifications whenever new instances spin up. And in fact, we can take this through any, you know, since we're a full REST-based API, we can really take this through any means necessary. So we have customers, maybe they're doing their own proprietary thing. They can still call into our APIs to start managing those workloads.
Now, obviously, this is a bit of a different direction than you first envisaged for the company when you started it. I mean, that's a fair statement, right?
Well, we knew it was a big problem, and it's an emerging problem that we wanted to tackle at some point. And when we saw, you know, the existing set of cyber attacks is largely based on the Windows Active Directory environments, but attackers are, you know, they're becoming much smarter. They're figuring out how to tie into these, you know, into these workloads, and it's much harder for organizations to understand what's running and understand who has privileged access there. So it was a natural progression from the way we've been thinking about the problem, but it is very different than how we were actually you know, doing our initial take in the Windows Active Directory realm. And us being a DevOps company, right, you know, we realized, oh, well, we have these own internal challenges. How do we effectively manage this and still make the solution as simple as possible for the end user at the end of the day?
Now, of course, Remedian is all about, you know, enabling accounts with privileged access through your console. So I guess in a way, I mean, is the Remedian gear at that point sort of becoming the, you know, the account directory as well? Because it sort of sounds like that.
Well, we're definitely playing an extension of the directory. So with Active Directory, we stay in full synchronization. So we always understand when group memberships are changing. And so we keep all of that information up to date. But then as we're taking in other resources, you know, we start having insights such as, you know, okay, the EC2 workloads, right? There's a very important set of data that we're collecting as well. And what we find our customers doing is querying and leveraging our APIs to get access to that data.
Yeah, I guess what I was sort of confused a bit about there is you did mention that, you know, some of these ephemeral resources, you don't want to have to do the whole, you know, Active Directory happy dance, right? So what, I mean, how are those ephemeral workloads and the privileged accounts attached to them actually being administered? I guess that's my question.
Yeah, so let me give you an example of how a user kind of interacts, and then what's happening behind the scenes on our platform when a user is accessing a Linux system. So rather than, you know, that Linux instance joining Active Directory, and then you have to do all the group membership management through sudoers access on that specific Linux box, what we'll do is become aware of that system, start managing all the sudo access on that Linux system. And then on our Secure One side, since we have synchronization from the Active Directory perspective, we can now define our Active Directory users and groups for who should have the ability to log on with administrative rights or root on that particular workload. And when an administrator wants to go and log in with those set of permissions, they just simply go through our web interface, say, hey, I need my just-in-time rights on this specific system. And what we'll do is we'll verify their group membership or their set of permissions and dynamically add them into the sudoers file using a local account binding.
Okay, but you're still
Active Directory credentials.
Now I understand, right? So you're still using Active Directory, but you're basically just seeing what they should be able to access by looking it up in Active Directory and then kind of reprovisioning it on the fly, which it makes sense, right? It works.
It does, right? And for the end user, it's like they don't really care. They just want the benefits of centralized authentication. So it's like, hey, I just need to log in with my username and password. Everything should be tied down to the user's own identity. But we don't need to get all messy behind the scenes of, you know, installing agents.
Yeah. You don't actually need the box itself to be trying to, do fancy stuff with Active Directory when you can just be the arbiter in the middle that says, yeah, Active Directory says it's okay. So we're going to provision those creds for a time-locked period. It makes a lot of sense.
That's right. And I mean, to be frank, nobody really wants to join Linux systems Active Directory. It's just the only method, until now that they've been able to leverage the directory for authentication purposes.
What's the uptake been with this, and where is it most popular, I guess, would be the question.
Yeah, so we're seeing a lot of enterprises that are either starting or in the middle of their cloud migration. So they're going full tilt on Azure, EC2. We even see some Google GCP instances coming up. But you know, companies are going through this and they're realizing, hey, we don't want to just inherit the same security problems that we know is in our on-prem, because these things are really different when they operate in these cloud environments. And to really achieve the benefits of a full horizontal scaling infrastructure, they really need to change their processes. And companies are starting to seek out some alternative solutions because what they've been using currently isn't scaling very, very well in their environments. A classic example is that I see is, you know, a company that might be using, you know, an agent based or something that's changing the authentication modules for the that Linux workload. Might be fine for their on-prem, which is an ephemeral, it's always there, and they go through that heavy lift. But when they try to spin this up in an automatic, you know, scaling infrastructure, you know, these workloads are taking a very long time to spin up. And so, you know, if anything isn't spinning up within a minute, then you're starting to lose the benefits of the whole point of doing a horizontal scaling infrastructure. So they need these workloads to spin up very, very quickly. A lot of these existing solutions, they replace the sudo command. And this is very challenging for DevOps teams that are trying to incorporate all of their tools because they're using, you know, other commands like, you know, like tzdo or like dzdo or pbrun. And this is something that, you know, just doesn't integrate well with these other tool sets. So, you know, again, we go with the same mantra of, hey, there should be low lift in these types of instances, and it should be very simple for the user to achieve the job that they're trying to do.
Now, I think when you first sponsored Risky Business, it would be something like 2 years ago, there were five of you at Remediant. You were a bootstrap startup. How many staff have you got now?
Yeah, so right now we're over 20, and we're actually on a big hiring path right now. So really looking to expand out the team to add more and more value to our customers.
Yeah, I'm curious too. Like, has the Windows side of things tapered off a bit for you over the last couple of years as people move to sort of different approaches, like mandatory 2FA on privileged accounts, that sort of stuff? I mean, I know there's like lots of environments where they're a long way from being able to do mandatory 2FA on privileged accounts. So, you know, something like this is a good way to get stuff done very quickly. But I'm just wondering how the Windows networks side of your business is going.
Yeah, you know, Windows is one of those areas that, you know, every company is still using it, so they're still facing the same types of challenges. You know, even when companies are using some of the later versions of Windows that have better guards around attacks like Pass the Hash or Mimikatz, there's still a lot of methods to account compromise. And when you have this in the Windows realm, because of their legacy authentication is still a big problem. So we're still seeing a lot of adoption in that realm.
All right. Well, Timothy Keeler, thank you very much for joining us on the show. And, you know, thanks a lot for sponsoring Risky Business. We appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me, Patrick.
That was Remediant's very own Tim Keeler there. If you think their stuff sounds useful, you can find them at remediant.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.